But our compass is only off by half a degree. What should that matter? Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to the Saturday edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
And I'm sitting here on a beautiful day with my faithful companion, Rufus the Wonder Dog, sitting at my feet while I prepare to do a serious analysis on a serious subject.
Yes, well, actually, this is very serious. And honestly, ladies and gentlemen, I think before the end of the hour, is if we haven't at least made you mad at something, we haven't done our job today. But we're going to be looking at some analysis, and we're going to be giving some analysis of things that are happening currently in our country and in international arenas by reviewing an article that was featured in the New Criterion magazine by Andrew McCarthy. Now, Chuck, you did a little bit of backgrounding, and Mr. McCarthy is a former U.S. District.
Yeah, he was a former attorney for the United States out of the Southern District of New York.
Yeah, right, the U.S. attorney, yes.
And he was involved in some of the prosecutions for things like the Sheikh who attempted to blow up the World Trade Center. The 1993 bombing, if you'll recall, the guy they attempted to blow up. Well, they didn't attempt. They did blow up a car down in the parking lot of the World Trade Center in an attempt to bring it down. It was Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman. He was the prosecutor on that case. He is a registered Republican. What that really means, it doesn't mean anything.
That's
Mitt Romney, not the Sheikh. Yeah, that's right, not the Sheikh. Mitt Romney's a Republican. That really doesn't mean anything. He has been active in quote-unquote conservative, really, truly neoconservative circles. He's not a constitutionalist. He is a neoconservative. Although some of the arguments in this article are definitely stolen from our camp, I would say.
And by our camp, we're talking about those who we would consider, as if you've ever listened to this program or you've listened to it historically, neither Chuck nor I would necessarily give ourselves the limiting label of conservative because we're not sure what many conservatives are trying to conserve. That's the reason why I think we would use probably a more archaic term, Chuck, and call ourselves somewhat paleo-conservatives because we're trying to conserve first things. The early principles, the absolutes of biblical authority and biblical truth, and reflect those upon our current situation. So, if anything, Chuck and I could be considered paleo-conservatives, which are old conservatives, versus, as Chuck used the phrase, neo-conservative, which I'm sure people have heard that bandied about, but neo is the prefix meaning new. So the new conservatism, which I think on a previous program, and you can go and listen to our archives, we had a fairly extensive quote by theologian and historical figure Robert Louis Dabney, where he basically talked about conservatism only being chasing after the innovation of liberalism and acceding to it and calling it the new status quo after a while. So that's the kind of neoconservatism that we're talking about versus what we hold to, which would be, I think, most aptly named paleoconservatism.
Yeah, I like that description. We do hold the first principles. We do not take an evolutionary viewpoint of how things should grow. We're not necessarily social contractors. We believe that government is ordained by God and that has implications and that liberty itself is actually also ordained by God, which is something that Mr. McCarthy can't quite seem to grasp.
Well, yeah, and that's only one of the startling issues with this article. But, you know, Chuck, as we look at this, and folks, like I said, you can find his article in the New Criterion magazine. That's at newcriterion.com, and it's titled Future Tense 8, Enter Totalitarian Democracy, and it's subtagged On the Difficulties of Making Law in the Modern World. Well, you know, Charles, it's just like we said at the beginning of the program, if your compass is only off by half a degree and you're not really understanding what that really means, when you don't arrive at your destination, you're sitting there puzzled as to why you didn't get there.
But it's funny you use that example because I used to use that example in my church. At one point I was arguing against certain types of curricula in the church. I was on the Sunday school board. And I would say, you know, this is only about 1 degree off. But I said, you know, if you fly 100 miles at 1 degree off, when you get to your destination, you'll be able to see the airport from where you are. So you won't be all that much lost. But if you fly around the world with a compass that's 1 degree off, you're going to end up way, way, way off.
Yeah, you could end up thousands of miles off of your intended destination.
Exactly.
If your compass is only off by a little bit, or if you don't, when you first set out, you don't check to make sure your compass is true. You know, and I was looking at this the other day. It's funny, Chuck, and I don't want to go into this in too great depth, but, you know, I sometimes read outdoor magazines and stuff like, you know, Backwoodsman and those kind of magazines. And they were talking about the fact that, you know, depending on where you are geographically in the country, you have to mentally think about it and have some background, because the closer you get to a pole, you're going to have a little bit of magnetic north versus true
That's
north
right.
issue. And so you're going to have to be careful and calibrate your compass before you start off, or else you're going to be lost.
Well,
you know,
Barry,
if you go wandering in the wilderness and you don't know where you are in relation to true north, you're in trouble.
If you've ever looked at a nautical map, and my father-in-law had a lot of nautical maps because he did a lot of boating, all nautical maps show you how far off from true north you are. So when you are dead reckoning, you can correct for how far off. And in fact, as you progress in different places, true north is in different places because there are effects from magnetic effects from things like large mountain ranges.
Yes.
So in the West, true north is different than it is here in the Midwest. True north is always true north, but the degrees off from true north on that'll show on a compass is different in the West near a large mountain range than it is here in the Midwest when we're fairly flat. So that's something that has to be taken account for. Now, why are we doing all this babbling? It's because it's important to understand it's not all that much different from looking at politics and first things and how these things apply in the public sphere.
Well, and that's the point I wanted to reach. You know, once we're giving them their brief lesson on orienteering and compass following, it's because, ladies and gentlemen, this is a prime example of what's wrong with Mr. McCarthy's article that we're going to be talking about today, is that if you don't know where you're starting from and you don't know what true north really is or what degree it's really set on, and you don't know the influences that you're starting off with, you could end up very much in the weeds by the time you reach your conclusion. And this is kind of where we see McCarthy, and we think most of the neoconservative philosophy and their presuppositional worldviews heading. Honestly, Chuck, the reason why, because, you know, he talks about totalitarian democracy, and of course, obviously, McCarthy is painting this as a prime evil in the world, because what he's doing is he's crying against the progressive left, which, you know, honestly, is a favorite whipping boy of all of us, paleoconservatives and the neoconservatives. But what he sets up, Chuck, his basic presupposition is that, first and foremost, we're a democracy.
And thus, the first false step in a journey of 10,000 miles in 1 degree off is taken.
Yeah, exactly.
Because we are not a democracy. We are a republic. And the definition of a republic is essentially a system of laws. Now, that's a little too simplistic. Our particular form of republic is a constitutionally limited government style republic.
Mm-hmm.
And because people get away with calling this a democracy because we democratically elect leaders. That doesn't make us a democracy. That makes us a republic with democratic elements. Because the fact is that we don't have universal suffrage here, which we would have in a democracy. You can't vote when you're 15. In the past, you haven't been able to vote if you're mentally incompetent in some way, although now
you can hold some of the highest offices in the land.
Well, that seems to be a Democratic Party stronghold insofar as, I'm not being facetious on this, basically Democrats will go into places where there are seniors who are no longer have all their mental faculties, register them to vote, and then help, quote unquote, help them vote on absentee ballots.
Isn't that loving and kind and thoughtful of them?
Oh yes, it's just amazingly loving and kind and thoughtful, especially when if overwhelmingly those unfortunate seniors who are now senile overwhelmingly vote Democratic straight ticket. Isn't that kind of shocking?
Well, yes, you know, it's one of those things that they think that's a non sequitur because, oh well, you know, just because we went in and registered them and told them how to vote doesn't mean that they voted our way.
Of course not. That's right. Just because we helped them, just because we sat there with the pen and filled out the form for them doesn't mean they voted our way.
Right.
But that's the kind of thing we're talking about. Mr. McCarthy starts out with a false premise, and that is that we are a democracy, and you can't get to the right conclusion with starting with a bad compass. That is a really bad compass.
But I want to set this up a little bit because what he's doing, he sets his tone with this article. McCarthy is prefacing this entire article by utilizing a quote from someone who our listeners would probably immediately understand as being highly liberal, and that is Associate Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who said, I quote, "I would not look to the U.S. Constitution if I were drafting a constitution in the year 2012. And McCarthy uses that as his jumping off point to start talking about how horrible it is to have progressive liberals and activists trying to use the law to basically set their own views of what's right. But the farther he goes in the article, just like with our missing compass set, he seems to drift off course and sometimes, at least in my estimation, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, starts setting up arguments against his own thesis. But the reason why he was so horrified at these comments from Ruth Bader Ginsburg is that she was presenting this speech while in Cairo, Egypt, basically at an invite from the Islamic leadership of Egypt, who are now setting a new constitution for the country of Egypt. And so what he's really trying to do is he's trying to paint the differences between U.S. constitutional law and Sharia law. And basically he uses the concepts of freedom and rights. And Chuck, I'm going to let you kind of wax on this one a little bit because you've thought through this particular section of his article a lot more deeply, I think, than I have.
Okay, one of the problems that we have with McCarthy's idea is that he believes, and he makes it clear in the article, that rights are the result of the evolution of the social compact, or the social contract, if you will. Same thing. He talks in terms of ordered liberty. Freedom is of, here's a quote from the article, "Freedom is of minimal interest to progressives, certainly not freedom as is commonly understood, namely the bedrock conceit that we are our own governors, autonomous over our own lives. To be clear, we are talking about freedom in a democracy, not an anarchy. In a rational social compact, freedom requires that we surrender a quantum of our independence to secure the nation and to honor the rudimentary norms of respect for life and property. If a free society is to flourish, nothing less than ordered liberty will do." Okay, ordered liberty is supposedly the surrendering of some of our rights in the form of an agreement. Well, that's not it at all. And as Barry, as constitutionalists and as biblical thinkers, we know that government is ordained by God.
Yes.
You do not surrender some of your rights to government. Basically, God, who is the person where rights come from. And this is something that McCarthy does not want, where he does not want to go, because he is, in effect, not just arguing against Sharia law. He is arguing against law that comes from any transcendental source.
That's right. And that's exactly what he gets down to. But, you know, Chuck, he basically builds this up because he's trying to set up the idea of human freedoms versus human rights.
Yes, exactly. Let's talk about this for just a second. He makes a statement in here that shows that he doesn't understand the difference between a privilege and a right. Because basically what he's saying in this totalitarian democracy versus a libertarian democracy, which is this dichotomy, this false dichotomy set up, in both cases, rights are essentially coming from government itself. Well, as we just discussed, rights don't come from government. They come from God. And what he's misapplying a definition to is the idea that a right is a privilege. A privilege is something that government gives you. A right is something that God gives you. For instance, the right to life, the right to the pursuit of happiness, the right to your liberty. Those are all given by God. They are not given by government. They're not part of the social contract. The purpose of the government is to protect those things, not to give them to you. Because those rights can be squelched, but they can never be taken away from you by any government system. And this is where McCarthy really stepped. He's more than one degree off here.
Very much so.
He's about 90 degrees off here. Well, so instead of flying straight east, he's flying straight south.
Exactly. Well, and the farther south he goes, the warmer it gets. But
that's right.
But basically, you know, certainly, Chuck, and I think our listeners would agree to this, that we would agree to him that we're not trying to promote an anarchy. And that when we use the term freedom, we mean it in its sense of liberty under law.
Exactly.
That we have a society only because we have a understanding, because no man is without excuse, Chuck, as the scripture says, that the law is written on our hearts. We know intrinsically, deep down, what's right and what's wrong. We know thou shalt not kill, although people murder all the time. We know thou shalt not steal, although people take from each other all the time. But then we formalize that in our civil laws, because if we didn't start with that absolute basis of what is true, our civil laws would create anarchy, because it would just be whoever has the strength. It would be the whole evolutionary Darwinian concept of the survival of the fittest. In other words, whoever was the most red in tooth and claw, as it goes, the lex talionis, would control everything, and we'd be back to a totally feudal society run by a handful of people who could muster enough power to force their will on the rest of the people around them.
Yeah, exactly. And what's really going on here, and pay close attention to Kingdoms, guys, is a misapplication of human reason to the idea that to that natural law that is written on our hearts. And all of a sudden, once you throw in man's reason, which is as flawed as it can be, you come up with bad ideas, such as the idea that privileges given by government are the same as rights.
Well, and I think we had a certain candidate who ran here in the last presidential cycle, making sure that that confusion was held deeply by his supporters. And I'm not saying who it was, because honestly, it was true of both of the major party candidates. They were doing the same thing. It was just that they were advocating for different, quote unquote, rights or privileges for their core constituencies.
Right. For instance, the right to an abortion, there is no such thing. Let's make that clear. God has given every human being the right to life, and simply calling it a right does not make it a right. There is no right to kill another human being except in self-defense. And ginning up an argument in your mind, applying human reason as a way to gin up the idea that somehow an infant growing in your womb is threatening your life, I'm sorry, that does not give you the right to kill that infant, because that argument is bogus on its face. Although you and I have run into people in supposedly quote unquote conservative circles who have attempted to apply that argument, have we not?
Absolutely. Well, I want to add this little thought here, because, you know, McCarthy talked about this whole idea about a rational social compact, and that we surrender a quantum of our independence to secure the nation and honor the rudimentary norms of respect for life and property. If a free society is to flourish, nothing less than ordered liberty will do. Well, ordered liberty, liberty under law, are interchangeable concepts, but it's not based in the same root idea. Now, exactly. I want to quote from another source, and I've got this up on my Facebook page. So if y'all want to go to my Facebook page and Google me up, Barry Sheets, but be careful because I think there's at least four Barry Sheets who live in Ohio who are on Facebook. You'll know me because I'm standing there with a document in my hand in front of a big Heartbeat Bill rally sign. So that's me. But if you go over to my notes page, I have a little excerpt from a book called The Manual of the Constitution of the United States, which was written in 1887 by the former president of Marietta College, Israel Ward Andrews. And he talks about the source of civil authority. And here's what he says. He says, it's not correct to say that civil society derives its authority through any compact or agreement, for then the power possessed by society would be limited to that received from the individual men composing the society. But the powers of government include those which never belonged to the individual man, and therefore could never have been conferred by him upon society. So in other words, we don't have the right to kill somebody for justice sake. I mean, if you think about that, that's a basic concept. The scripture does say that man sheds blood, then by man his blood shall be shed. But that's talking about bringing somebody to justice through law and executing a death penalty. He says, basically, he gets down to this whole idea, men cannot give what they do not possess, and society could never obtain its right to govern from the individual citizens since they never had such a right. And he keeps going. He says, the authority of civil society is not, then, derived from the individual citizens composing that society. They surrender nothing. Society receives nothing. The fallacy in the theory of the social compact, considered as an explanation of the origin of civil government, consists in confounding men as individuals with men as constituting a community. Whenever an independent community of men can be found, there is already civil society. There is no necessity for men to surrender a part of their rights in order to form a basis for authority. The authority exists without any such surrender. In society, man has all the rights which he could have in any state of nature, if any such state of nature out of society can be conceived of. As already has been said, society is the natural state of man. It appears from the above that society is of divine origin. It is the intention of our Creator that we should live in society and under government, as it is that the race should be grouped into families and the child be subject to his parents. So he says, no individual man has the divine right to be a king, but as civil government is of divine origin, society has a divine right to have rulers. Whoever, therefore, exercises legitimately any function of the civil ruler, whether he be king or president, legislator or judge, is exercising an authority which is as divine in its origin as is the authority of a parent over his child. So basically he's saying the authority is held by the nation as a whole and not by the people as individuals. Society is not a congress of sovereigns. So basically, Andrews is saying there is a object higher than men's individual quote-unquote rights, because I don't have the right, Chuck, to rule you. And you don't have the right to rule me. But when we gather together in community, we set rules together so that we can live in harmony.
That's a very interesting thing in light of what McCarthy writes here. This is where he begins to mix up this idea of rights and privileges. The modern left's métier, and this is apparently a French word, but what it means is vocation or a calling, is rights in the contemporary connotation. That is, what you must give to me with governments handling both the confiscation and redistribution ends of the arrangement. In contrast to the traditional rights, Justice Ginsburg finds so unrefined, to wit, the right to be free from government demands and the right to have government restricted to its expressly enumerated powers. Okay, this shows a mix-up, again, of rights and privileges, although he gets the thing right. We do have the right to be free from government, certain kinds of government demands, and the right to have government restricted to its expressly enumerated powers. Yes, those are rights. What isn't a right is to have anybody in charge of either end of the confiscatory machine. That is, when you think about it, is what the modern connotation of rights is. But of course, those aren't rights at all. Now, what goes on here later on is McCarthy shows that he's mixed up insofar as he starts out with his view of mankind. And he says, liberal democracy, by contrast, assumes politics to be a matter of trial and error. It takes human beings as being basically good, but incorrigibly fallible. Well, Barry, is that the biblical view of mankind?
Basically good, but incorrigibly fallible. Now, if you're incorrigible, Chuck, that means that there's no governing on you. But if you're basically good, that means that you should be driving toward all doing good at all times. So those two things can't even fit in the same sentence together with any kind of logical cohesion, and neither certainly are a honest reflection of what the truth is from a biblical standpoint. The biblical standpoint is we are born into sin. We, from our first father, Adam, it was extended upon the entire race, and that the only way to get past that sin and that, as the reformers would say, that total depravity of man is by the saving grace of Christ Jesus, renewing your heart and giving you a reformed spirit. Our basic nature is that man is evil. And as the scripture continues to say that, you know, the imaginations of man's heart were evil continually. The heart is, in Jeremiah, it says the heart is deceitful and desperately wicked. Who could know it? That basically, and of course, as we, you know, and look in the book of Joshua, it says, when there was no king in Israel, every man did that which was right in his own eyes.
Exactly. Now, think about this. He goes on here. He talks about the avatars of totalitarian democracy maintain that they have arrived at a sole and exclusive truth. Consequently, the personal becomes the political. The car you drive, the clothes you wear, and the movies you watch, it all becomes, as President Barack Obama is fond of saying, a teachable moment. Politics is not on the sideline. It is the juggernaut that perfects mankind in accordance with the totalitarian truth. Law is the principal instrument by which this overwhelming force is wielded. Well, what he's trying to do, again, he's setting up a false dichotomy here that talks about how from the conservative side, we attempt to see man as basically good, but incorrigibly fallible, and that liberals look at man as ultimately perfectible through the power of government. Well, what he's saying here is essentially that conservatives and liberals look at these things almost exactly the same way, just a little bit different. Well, I would say no. Now, I would say that we have you and I would probably say that we have a view that there is a proper way to run the civil authority, and it's somewhat different than the liberals think, because at the basis is not the basic goodness of man. It is Christian liberty. I don't know. Of course, he's not going to go there, because that in essence implies something that he doesn't want to talk about, and that is theocracy. And before everybody goes apoplectic, the fact is that every government on the face of the earth is a theocracy.
That's right.
Whether anybody wants to admit it or not, the fact is that the source of a nation's laws are that nation's God. And here, basically, McCarthy is making the same mistake that the liberals are, and they're trying to make the citizens of the nation, the God of the nation. And in fact, the only God of any nation is God. So now all of a sudden, again, we're off 90 degrees. Instead of flying straight east, we're flying straight south. And it will be getting warmer.
Now, Chuck, you seem to be drifting into these waters that McCarthy is very, very concerned about by saying that you assume that there's a sole and exclusive truth in politics.
It's an inescapable conclusion, well, Barry. There is, and again, to our Two Kingdoms listeners, sorry, guys.
But McCarthy tries to set this up, Chuck, as we talked about before, between what he calls the totalitarian democratic school and their form of what he says political messianism. In other words, salvation by politics. Now, you and I have heard that thrown around and bandied about in theological circles a number of times because of people who are concerned about someone who actually should say that God's word speaks into the civil arena, and that's your reference to Two Kingdoms, folks.
Exactly.
But then he tries to balance it off by doing a yin and yang kind of thing. You know, if you have one side, you've got to have another, and his other side of the coin is liberal democracy, which assumes politics to be a matter of trial and error.
Yes.
Well, I would strike that it's more error and creates more trials, because you forget that there is an ultimate goal, there is an ultimate authority, and yes, there is a sole and exclusive truth, even in politics. Believe that sole and exclusive truth said in Matthew 28:18, all authority has been given me in heaven and in earth. That was Jesus Christ, our Lord, who said that directly to his disciples. And when he meant all authority, he didn't mean all spiritual authority or all authority for soul winning. He meant all authority over everything in heaven and in earth. So there's no sphere, there's no segment of our life here on planet earth, whether it be politics, education, business, our families, our recreation, our worship, that Jesus Christ doesn't, as Abraham Kuyper, the former Dutch prime minister, said, that Christ doesn't say and make a claim mine to, that all things are under his authority.
And this, of course, puts the lie to certain Two Kingdoms types who have been claiming themselves to be Kuyperian. And I listen to them, I laugh when they say that, because they certainly do not believe that everything is in the control of Jesus Christ, because Abraham Kuyper expressed that exact sentiment. These fellows will tell you a rather silly story that, yes, Jesus Christ is in charge of everything, but he treats the civil realm differently than he treats the rest of his kingdom. Well, that's absurd on its face. The immutable God basically is different in one place than he is in another. I don't think so. That flies in the face of any kind of biblical reasoning.
Well, it's not just even reasoning. It flies in the face of a express biblical comment from God. It says, I am the Lord thy God, I changeth not. And
and
that was in reference to the people trying to say that, well, God was going to work differently in this situation than he had in the past. God said, no, I am the Lord thy God, I changeth not. And so basically what he's saying is God's not going to be vacillating. He's not going to be capricious. He stated clearly in his word what he expects from us. This is the same God who tells us what he expects from us, which is to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with him, not to set up ourselves as our own autonomous authority, call it a liberal democracy, and act like that we have ordered liberty because we're setting our own standards. You see, setting our own standards against a God who has absolute truth and who has made a claim that's irrefutable upon your obedience, that's the definition of anarchy, ladies and gentlemen. So it may look ordered in the political sphere, but we're actually in rebellious anarchy to God. And that's part of the reason why things are falling apart.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, here's one of the problems you run into, Barry. When you make the assumption that the voice of the people is the voice of God, then essentially what you have done is surrendered to anarchy. I got into a Facebook discussion the other day with a couple of individuals who are clearly anarchists. They're anarcho-libertarian, but they're from the left side. And essentially what I started, they started handing me the old leftist version, wage slaves, talking about wage slaves and how these people were cheated. And I'm like, no, don't give me that. I said, well, I went back to basic economics. They contracted to work for a certain amount of money. When you contract to work for a certain amount of money, you have two choices. You can either remake the contract or go make a contract with somebody else for more money if you think you can. And if you can't, then you have a choice of starting your own business so you can try to make more money, or making yourself a better employee so that you're worth more money. But the fact is, these guys were talking about going back and suing former employers once you've decided you've been ripped off through your wage slavery. And if you can't do that, then the masses should be called out to come out in support of you. And I'm like, okay, that's the kind of anarchy I'm talking about. You suddenly decide you've been cheated in a contract, and now later, after the fact, you're going to collect more by force. And if by necessary, it won't necessarily be at gunpoint. What they'll do is use the courts. Well, this is exactly what McCarthy's pointing at. But the problem is, he's made the same mistake. He's made the same mistake in that what we need to do is convince the majority of people that they need to be libertarian from the right side rather than using the coercive power of government to get what they want. Well, no, both are equally wrong because they both lead to the same point. And that's the problem we're running into here, Barry. This argument basically is circular at its end point. It comes back around to the same spot. The majority rules, the voice of the majority is the voice of God. And as we have been discussing all along, no, it's not.
Oh, absolutely not. In order to do that, what we're doing, and this is the reason why I say that McCarthy actually, by the time he gets done, is confuting his own argument, is because he's complaining at first about these justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who don't want to be bound by the Constitution and go off to, you know, embrace and trumpet international law and international treaties, which we're going to talk about here in a minute. But then he gets around to say that, well, you know, we can't have any kind of absolute standard, so therefore, we're just going to, honestly, in essence, logically, Chuck, we're just going to replace one oligarchic structure, the U.S. Supreme Court, with another oligarchic structure, i.e. whatever the neoconservatives come up with, to say that by social contract, everybody has to cede their rights so that the neocons have exactly what they think is a perfect society or a utopia, which,
yeah,
outside of God, that's what all men are trying to do when they try to control and become rulers. They're trying to set up their own version of a social utopia, a perfect society in which all want and care and pain and suffering and toil are set aside by the beneficent administrations of a government run by them, of course.
Well, he attempts to get around this. I think he sees that there's a problem here. So he attempts to get around it. And he talks about, in that thing you quoted about messianism, he says this: totalitarian Democrats, also known as progressives, have feigned homage to the centrality of freedom since the French Revolution. But whereas the conservative, that is the classic Burkean liberal, finds the essence of freedom in what Talman describes as spontaneity and the absence of coercion, progressives like Justice Ginsburg and President Barack Obama believe it to be realized only in the pursuit and attainment of an absolute collective purpose. Now, he's beginning to go into a thing about Rousseau here, and that is Rousseau, the common will, that basically the way democracy works is And if you'll recall, you and I, when we did our research project on the Federalist Papers, we've noticed a couple of times that, for instance, Alexander Hamilton made reference to the common will.
Yes.
Which pointed him out as actually a student of Rousseau rather than, for instance, Locke, who had a more biblical view. Rousseau was a, more of a, well, he was an enlightened democracy guy. And basically Rousseau talked openly about if people won't conform with the general will, then they could be coerced into conforming with the general will. And that's exactly, what the dichotomy that McCarthy is attempting to draw here. And unfortunately, again, it fails because, this idea of spontaneity in the absence of coercion always turns into under the quote unquote enlightened properties of man's free will and his flawed reasoning applied to natural law always ends up being coercive. It can't go any other direction because man's reason is flawed and corrupt.
Yeah, that's, you're absolutely correct because that is what the truth is. But again, you know, like you said, he sets up Rousseau here because he starts, as he's talking about this social contract idea, he's using Rousseau kind of as a whipping boy against what he considers the totalitarian Democrats. But I argue that liberal democracy, as he's trumpeting, which assumes politics to be a matter of trial and error, and allows for what he says, the essence of freedom, as you mentioned from his quotes from Joshua Talman, Jacob Talman, it's spontaneity and the absence of coercion. Well, you know, Chuck, that's all fine and well, except for the fact that you still get back around to the Rousseauian social contract for your ultimate way of having government work, even under those conditions. You don't get to ordered liberty based on a true understanding of man's nature and a true expression of the balances and the order that God has given in his word so that man can live together. I mean, that's part of the reason for the law being written on our hearts, so that we have, even internally, know that taking another's life is wrong, that taking the possessions of someone is wrong, that binding, that being covetous of someone to the point of wanting to take away their liberty so that you can get something that they might have gotten in your place is wrong. When our founders wrote in the Declaration that idea that our the inalienable rights that are coming from the Creator of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that's what they were looking at, that God had established those basic things and given us rules in our hearts and through the collective idea of community and society to prevent us from violating his laws.
Yeah, and this coming from the hand of someone who's about as far from an Orthodox Christian as you can get. And what's interesting about that is when Thomas Jefferson drafted that and he showed it to the other members of the committee who, for the most part, were Orthodox Christians, they had no problem with it. And the reason they had no problem with it was because even though Jefferson was not Orthodox in his belief, he had a Christian worldview. And McCarthy is showing, basically arguing that a Christian worldview is not necessarily desirable. That it's better to have a secular worldview. Again, much the same as some of our Two Kingdoms friends. I found one thing that kind of disturbed me, and I found a logical fallacy being used, a direct logical fallacy that was essentially an attempt to slam Sharia law. Now, there's a lot to slam in Sharia law, but what he basically, this was a bad argument. Only one thing is certain about the Constitution, the Muslim Brotherhood and its Islamist coalition partners will establish. Section 2 of the current Constitution, that's the Egyptian Constitution, which makes Islam's repressive Sharia supreme, will remain sacrosanct and be given real teeth. Ginsburg thinks our 230-year-old constitution is outdated, but at 1,400 years old and counting, Islam's totalitarian legal code is practically primeval, and yet here it is born anew. Well, let me tell you something, Barry. The principles of the government that we are espousing is over 5,000 years old. Does age have anything to do with anything? This is an appeal to modernity, basically saying, well, our constitution is much more modern than Sharia law. No, it's not. It's ancient. The ideas behind the United States Constitution are as old as mankind itself. They're as old as creation. The fact that somebody basically sat down and codified them much later, over 4,700 years later, doesn't mean anything. The fact is that the guide has always been God. And, you know, basically saying that Sharia is somehow the word of God is to conflate Allah and the God of the Bible, who are not the same thing. Despite the liberal idea that they are not. And this is one of the problems that McCarthy has. I would guess that he probably buys into this, the three branches of the monotheist God, and that Allah, you know, is an equal member of that branch. No. Allah is an entirely different God from the God of the Bible. He has an entirely different personality. He has an entirely different character. He does not have a son who came to sacrifice for our sins. He is an entirely different person, and in fact, a non-existent person.
Exactly.
If that gets me a fatwa, then I guess I'll take it.
I was going to say, and a fatwa will be issued against you momentarily, I guess. You know, but and that's the whole thing here, Chuck. You know, he talks about, and he keeps going in this article, and you're right. There's a lot of things in here that are wrong. And he talks about this whole idea of the Constitution writing that happened post-World War II, that's why he set up the entire article with the Ginsburg quote.
Exactly.
Was basically saying has become totalitarian democracy's cognate version of social engineering. And you know what? He's right to an extent that throwing off things that have absolute value or are based in absolute truth in order to rewrite the whole thing to fit your new progressive or socially enlightened position in the modern age has caused those kind of problems. But it's the same kind of problems that if you go through and you read McCarthy carefully, he's actually going to advocate by the time he gets done. You know, because he starts talking about this whole idea of that we can't have, that he said this, the regression of this dealing with human rights versus freedoms, as he set it up, from the venerable law of nations enshrined in our Constitution. Is the law of nations enshrined in our Constitution, Charles?
Yeah, actually it is.
That's right, it is. It is. But in case people didn't recognize that, it is. There are some things in there in a couple spots. To today's amorphous international humanitarian law mirrors the ongoing contortion of domestic rights from freedom-preserving safeguards enjoyed by all citizens. And really, is that what we have now today, Chuck, with our domestic rights?
Oh, absolutely not. And in fact, let's go to a quote from Talman that shows kind of the difference, the reason why we should stop thinking in terms of democracy and go to a reason why we should start thinking in terms of republic, and in other words, a system of laws, of basic laws which protect the individual, protect the minority rather than leaving the minority out there hanging to the general will, in Rousseau's terms. The difficulty could only be resolved by thinking not in terms of men as they are, but as they were meant to be and would be given the proper conditions. Insofar as they are at variance with the absolute ideal, they can be ignored, coerced, or intimidated into conforming without any real violation of the democratic principle being involved. In the proper conditions, it is held the conflict between spontaneity and duty would disappear, and with it the need for coercion. The practical question is, of course, whether constraint will disappear because all have learned to act in harmony or because all opponents have been eliminated. in a republic. You can't eliminate your opponents.
No, you cannot.
In a democracy, just doesn't matter what kind of democracy, you know, he's talking about this limited democracy, but that's not a democracy. That's a republic. Okay. This is the problem. We can't say there are two types of democracy because there aren't. There's one type. We live in a republic. He is arguing in favor of republican government. He's trying to play to this idea that we can have two different types of the same thing. No, you can't. And this is where the confusion comes in, Barry.
Well, it's not just confusion, Chuck. The whole idea when you're trying to hold two polar opposite concepts together in your head.
Yeah, eventually they explode. It's like trying to hold two north poles of a magnet together.
Yeah, basically it's called cognitive dissonance. In other words, you can't do it and remain sane for very long, and neither can a society hold to two entirely diametrically opposed concepts of right or concepts of freedom or concepts of governing and still expect to hold together in a cohesive whole that has peace and quiet.
Yeah, exactly. It's going to explode at some point. Either your head's going to explode, or you're going to come out with an article where basically you write self-contradictory things. And unfortunately, that's what's gone on here. Now, one of the reasons that we went to this article is because we agree with McCarthy's points regarding new constitution writing.
Absolutely.
And as you know, you and I are very familiar with one of those new constitutions that's been written since 1945. And that is this new state's constitution, which we have actually been implementing little by little, piece by piece, inch by inch. And we are now have quote unquote conservative groups who are pushing for a new constitutional convention who think they can call one that will be quote unquote controlled by the states and that will be controlled only writing amendments to the Constitution, blah, 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 blah. And we've debunked that over and over and over again. If you don't think so, listen to last week's show. Listen to several shows from last week where we talked about that issue. Go to our website and read our position on a new constitutional convention. The fact is that once we get a new constitutional convention called, it will be people like Ruth Bader Ginsburg who are in charge of appointing delegates. And don't kid yourself that that's going to happen. They will have heavy influence on what is written. They will have heavy influence on who's appointed to these things. And what we're going to get is exactly the thing that McCarthy is arguing against in this article. Because this is the modern zeitgeist, Barry. It's this idea that we are replacing God-given rights with government awarded and quote unquote guaranteed privileges. And that's what that whole discussion was at the beginning of the show. The difference between a right and a privilege. Rights are God given, privileges are given by government. And privileges that are given by government can be taken away by government. Rights that are given by God can only be taken away by God. And since God is immutable, we have them.
That's right.
And that is a major, major, major difference between these two viewpoints and even the viewpoint that McCarthy is espousing here.
Well, you know, and it's interesting, Chuck, because he plays a dangerous game in this article, ladies and gentlemen, because he starts setting up the Constitution versus treaty law. Now, that's one of the things that he's concerned about, and I think many of us are. And if you take our course on the U.S. Constitution at the Institute on the Constitution, we'll explain to you the difference between treaties and the Constitution, and that the two things are not to be conflated with each other, nor are they equal in authority. And that's what he's trying to get at here, so I applaud him for this, to try to unpack that. But then he plays a very dangerous game after he talks about all these monstrosities of treaties, especially like the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child or the Convention on Human Rights. And basically saying that, you know, that as they're trying to push this through by treaty, he says, for the most part, the authoritarian and redistributive components of these monstrosities would stand little chance of being enacted into domestic law by Congress. Well, Chuck, I think that bleeds right into what we're talking about new constitutional conventions, because that's another one of the dangers of opening up for an Article 5 con that we've been talking about, is this whole idea that, well, what happens if they decide that, well, okay, as long as we can just get them to open the Constitution, we can stick all this in here, change the ratification procedures, and we've done it. Because as far as, especially the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, the United States is the only country, except for South Sudan, which recently came into existence, that has not ratified that treaty. We're the only nation on the face of the earth that has not ratified that treaty yet. But when they push and they push and they push, they can get us to open the Constitution, they can get the treaty actually made part of the new law of the land. But then he says that basically, and he goes on, this is the game that he plays, because he's threatening the natural sovereignty of the United States by saying the palpable objective of these precautions, and he's talked about how, okay, the Constitution allows us to ratify treaties with the President's approval and consent of the Senate, and that while we're doing it, if we get a treaty that we don't like, instead of just nullifying it and then getting the disapprobation of the world community looking at us like we're some kind of a monstrosity sitting there with a third eye in the middle of our foreheads, that the Senate could just go in and they can make some editing to these treaties and ratify them with the various provisos that we'll only hold to it for this, this, and this. And he says that basically that enables practical politicians to nullify lunatic treaties, which, while ostensibly endorsing both the ideal of human rights and the illusion of an international community, he said the Constitution was once our insurance against the consequences of these shenanigans. Well, Chuck, what he's advocating is greater shenanigans to allow the U.S. Senate to basically put us into a treaty where we're the only country on the face of the earth that has signed and or recognizes certain limitations on the extent of how the treaty's enforcement mechanism would work on us. Now,
yeah, exactly.
Now, that's great for our sovereignty, but what happens if after you sign this treaty that all of a sudden it's like, well, now all these cases on these treaties are going to be heard at The Hague at the International Court of Justice. Oh, and by the way, the United States, since you're going to be tried a little bit differently because we're not recognizing these provisos that you've written in there, but you signed the treaty, so now it's the law of the land according to your Constitution. Well, Chuck, that begs another question that McCarthy just totally punts on in this article, and that is the whole idea that a treaty, even if it's ratified, cannot violate the United States Constitution. If it goes over, above, beyond, or is in direct contradiction to the expressed operation and function of the United States Constitution, it can't be ratified in the first place.
Well, he does kind of cover it. Unfortunately, Barry, we're running real short on time here. But he does kind of cover it earlier on, but he shows a little bit of confusion over whether or not this works or not. The Constitution makes treaties as law of the land, provided they follow a fairly arduous ratification procedure, presidential agreement approved by 2/3 of the Senate. But nothing about the rule of law is ever simple for long. Isn't that true? Once ratified, a treaty has the same legal force as a statute, or does it? In theory, a statute cannot override the Constitution, but in an obscure 1920 case, the Supreme Court held that by striking down a treaty with Great Britain that regulated the hunting of migratory birds, the federal government effectively preempted the laws of Missouri, something that federalism and the separation of powers principle barred Congress from doing. Bird hunting having always been a matter of sovereign state control. So could Leviathan, by making a treaty with, say, Mexico, degrade or eviscerate other powers our allegedly outdated Constitution reserves to the states or to the people? What does one suppose Justice Ginsburg would say? Well, that's obvious. Justice Ginsburg would go international on us in a minute. But the fact is, what McCarthy has stumbled onto is the fact that in Article 6 of the Constitution, it says that treaties must be made in pursuance to the Constitution. which means that the rights of the states and the people cannot be surrendered through the use of treaty. And therefore, he sort of dances around this, but he's asking you what you think Justice Ginsburg would do. And therein lies the rub, Barry. Therein lies the rub. Well, we are out of time, and therefore, I'm going to ask you to join us on Monday for another Principles and Policies.